afternoon. I can't believe anyone made it to this session, so I really appreciate it. I do just want to add a note. I'm actually no longer working with an adolescent study. No one was. It's still up on my picture. But now my work is actually mostly with the sexuality and health experience, also at the University of Michigan. And that's sort of where these data are coming from today. So the title of my presentation is I Have Your Results, Delivering Evaluation Data to HIV and STI Testing Regarding Issues of LGBT Sensitivity. I don't have anything to disclose. So let's just dive right in and talk a bit about HIV and sexually transmitted infections, or STIs, in the state of Michigan. So Michigan ranks in the top 15 among all states in the U.S. in terms of current gonorrhea and chlamydia infection rates. Southeast Michigan in particular, including the cities of Detroit, Flint, and Ann Arbor, carry the burden of new STI cases, and the region is also the epicenter of the state's HIV epidemic. So thinking more specifically about HIV and STIs in Michigan among young gay and bi men, or MSM, as they're called in our epidemiological data profiles, we see that they comprise 53% of all new cases in the state. So in the 13 to 19 age range, 70% of new HIV cases are among MSM. So we've also seen rising rates of primary and secondary syphilis among young MSM, particularly in the city of Detroit. And we know that we have significant rates when it comes to HIV STI co-infection as well. So in 2011, for example, 77% of all gonorrhea and HIV co-infections in the state were among MSM. So you'll notice that throughout my talk today, I'll sometimes use the terms gay and bisexual men, whereas other times I might say men who have sex with men, or MSM. I refer to our participants as gay and bisexual men, as that's what the young men in the communities where we work, those are the terms and the language that they prefer. But when I'm reporting epidemiological data, I use what's presented in the original source, which is MSM. So, and I'm also using the term LGBT cultural competency, as that's the broad term that's used by federal agencies when they're sort of addressing the care of folks, you know, anywhere on the rainbow spectrum. But to be clear, this work was funded only to focus on cisgender, gay, and bisexual men, a fact which I would say merits its own discussion in public health circles, but one which I won't be covering today. So there are many factors that we can point to that are contributing to the trend of rising HIV STI rates in Southeast Michigan among young gay and bi men, all of which demand our attention as public health professionals. But today I want to focus on one of these issues specifically, and that is a lack of LGBT cultural competency among providers who are engaged in service delivery in our communities. So HRSA defines cultural competency as, and this is a long one, so hang with me, congruent behaviors, attitudes, and policies that come together to enable systems, agencies, and professionals to work effectively in cross-cultural situations that empower care providers to deliver services in a manner that is respectful to a patient's culture or individual identity. So in the context of STI testing and young gay and bi men, it means having a provider or a test counselor who is trained, respectful, and comfortable with the idea of providing care for men who have sex with other men. So in recent years, large public health institutions such as the CDC and the Department of Health and Human Services have called for increasing attention to ensuring a culturally competent workforce to serve LGBT populations. But not much is known about how providers actually feel about this concept of LGBT cultural competency, nor about the increased focus on it in healthcare settings. So cultural competency is also notoriously difficult to measure, given that perceptions of competence, or lack thereof, are sometimes hard for patients to describe or express, and providers themselves often don't know what they don't know. So we therefore set out to create opportunities to have conversations with HIV STI test counselors and providers about LGBT cultural competency. We wanted to know how providers thought about LGBT cultural competency at their sites and what some of the barriers might be to practicing it. So these conversations with providers eventually took place as part of an online pilot intervention called Get Connected. So I'm just going to tell you a little bit about Get Connected, as I think it provides a useful context for understanding the provider's take on LGBT cultural competency. So Get Connected was a feasibility study funded by the CDC, whose ultimate goal was to link young gay and bi men in Southeast Michigan with HIV, STI testing sites that met their health needs based on an initial survey and tailored messaging. So in order to link young men to these sites, we need to have some sense of how they might fare, how the sites might fare on various indicators. And this is where our secret shoppers came in. So secret shopping is a participant observation approach that sort of synergizes standardized patient method that you see in medical training oftentimes with mystery shopping strategies that are used in commercial marketing. So we trained 5 research assistants, all of whom were young gay men, to conduct site visits at 46 sites around Southeast Michigan. And at each site, the secret shopper would get tested, and then he would offer his observations and impressions of the experience. So each site was visited by 2 young men at 2 different times. So after each visit, the shoppers filled out a 50-item questionnaire about the site, which included multiple items on LGBT cultural competency. So then they did an overall write-up of their experiences at the site, and we used that data to rank the sites on various indicators and program the intervention to offer site recommendations to participants. So these procedures were approved by the Institutional Review Board at the University of Michigan. So once the intervention was complete, we mailed for each of the 46 sites a letter stating the aims of the project and inviting staff to contact us if they wished to hear how their site performed on various indicators and in relation to all the sites as a whole. So upon receiving responses, we set up meetings with each agency and we spent the next several months delivering results. And so just to give you an example of what the results looked like that we were giving to agency staff, so here we have one of the bar charts that displayed several secret shopper responses to the questionnaire that they filled out at the end of their site visit. So for example, one variable would be the provider was judgmental about the kind of sex I have. So the top bar is the site score, the middle bar is the median of all sites, and the bottom bar is the mean of all sites. The further the bar is to the right, the better. So basically, for this one, what you can see is that this site actually did quite well, scoring at or above average on all indicators. We also offered agencies the text of the secret shopper's qualitative impressions after modifying quotes to protect identities. So in this example, the person getting tested recounts, "The nurse and nurse's assistant were both very kind and conversational. I got no sense of judgment from them when I said I only had sex with men. The nurse was also sure to counsel me regarding having safe sex with men, which hasn't happened a lot on these secret shopping trips." So overall, 30 sites requested feedback, which was roughly 2 out of 3, and nearly all meetings were in person, with the exception of those that ended up being scheduled on days where we got 2 feet of snow, which happened quite a bit last winter, unfortunately, and looks like it's happening again. So these meetings really became a chance for us to have a candid dialogue about providing competent services to young gay and bi men. After each one, we recorded detailed field notes in which we recalled the conversations and added our general impressions of the meeting and of the agency response. So we then analyzed our field notes using a phenomenological approach and identified patterns across agencies that corresponded to our initial impressions. So overall, we observed some key patterns in how agencies responded to the secret shopper process and feedback meetings. A few agencies reacted defensively to the feedback that our shoppers felt less than comfortable. As one nurse stated, quote, "Some young men just come in and they have that chip on their shoulder because they've already decided that they hate you, like they might their mom or their sister," end quote. Other agencies admitted to initially feeling apprehensive about getting the results, but ultimately decided that they could be useful. One administrative nurse summarized it well. She said, "At first when we got the letter, we felt defensive, but then we sat down as a team and we decided that the feedback would give us a chance to grow and potentially improve our services." Another agency representative stated that while he felt confident that they, quote, did good work with LGBT clients, he nevertheless felt great relief upon getting positive feedback. And finally, several agencies that received stellar results were sincerely eager to get more resources and training, stating that there is always room for improvement when it comes to culturally competent service provision. So, agency staff identified 5 primary barriers to providing culturally competent services to LGBT populations. So first, agency decision-making structures. So at Agency A, our secret shoppers had been told that since they fell under the category of MSM, they had to test for all STIs, including a blood draw for syphilis. When one shopper declined, saying he preferred to do only an oral swab for chlamydia and gonorrhea, he was told that he wasn't allowed to pick and choose his tests, that it was all or nothing. When offered this scenario in the feedback session, Agency A's staff informed us that this was the policy of their medical director and that providers who didn't follow suit could be reprimanded. So at Agency B, personnel spoke about how space constraints due to limited funding made it harder to protect client identities. For example, in the waiting room, there might be several people within hearing distance as the receptionist asked a client personal questions, including ones about sexual behavior. So several agencies that offered testing didn't actually do the testing themselves, but rather they would contract it out to various health departments or AIDS service organizations that were in the area. And these agencies were concerned that they sort of lacked an ability to impose quality control on the testing services that these other agencies were providing, and they felt that this might be a barrier to best serving young gay and bi men. So personnel in tight funding situations lamented that oftentimes the materials available to them to give to clients were seriously outdated or inappropriate for LGBT populations, and that this created a disconnect with the client. Finally, the last barrier is one that our team identified as opposed to one that was voiced by the providers themselves. The issue is encapsulated well by the interaction at one particular agency where several uncomfortable incidents had occurred that made it clear that this agency wasn't providing an optimal experience for gay-identified youth. When I relayed these issues to agency staff, they replied that the incidents absolutely could not have happened, given that all of their test counselors had undergone LGBT sensitivity training. So many of the barriers identified by the HIV-STI testing sites, I think, can be tackled, especially as resources are made available for improving service provision among LGBT populations. The deeper barrier identified in the last case, however, is not so easily solved. So as agencies participate in training, whether mandated or voluntary, they may have a sense that they have checked the issue of LGBT competency off their list. Nearly 20 years ago, Turvalon and Garcia warned us about this possibility when they introduced their cultural humility framework. Cultural humility as an approach recognizes that providing the best care in any realm is a process. It's one that is iterative and in need of monitoring and maintenance. Cultural humility can also be described as a commitment to continual learning, self-reflection, and attention to power imbalances. So I would therefore conclude today by stating that public health initiatives that push for LGBT competency would be wise to integrate the principles of cultural humility so that as clients' needs change, providers can use these principles as a model of how to adapt. Thank you. Actually, it was really, so we had a community advisory board for this project that was made up of folks working at ASOs and at other STI testing agencies. And when the shoppers had sort of these bad experience and also had really great experiences, we really needed to make a decision as a research team about, okay, we have, you know, a couple of choices here. We can say nothing to these agencies or we can try to give them feedback or, you know, we weren't sure what to do. And actually our community advisory board, they were the ones who came up with the idea of send a letter. Don't call, because if you call out of the blue, or it could just, people could have, understandably, a reaction, a feeling blindsided. And so we felt like sending a letter was a way that people could open the letter, sit with it for a minute, and then they could make a decision about whether they wanted to reach out. And so it was on them. So once they got the letter, we didn't contact them again. And so then two-thirds of them, though, did reach out to us and ask for the feedback. We felt like, so again, discussion that we had in depth with our community advisory board, and we felt like given the fact that we did not communicate beforehand that we were going to these sites, and furthermore that we do a lot of community-based work in which we work with a lot of these agencies, that it wouldn't necessarily be in anyone's best interest to necessarily sort of publish, or not publish, but put out there, you know, for general consumption. But what we have talked about doing is in the future taking this site and making it into sort of like a Yelp site, but for testing among young gay and bi men, and then they could go on and sort of, and they could say, I went to agency A, and, you know, Teresa's amazing, I would totally go see her, she's, you know, she's great. I went to testing B, it was awful, I would never go back. And so then young men themselves could sort of use that resource internally in their community, rather than, there's also sort of the element there of the university coming and saying, like, you did this, and, like, you're not doing this correctly, and we didn't also want to be in that position, given that, again, we do a lot of community work, so. You know, to be completely honest with you, a lot of people have asked us that. We were exempt. Because it was an evaluation study, evaluation of existing services, and under Michigan's IRB, so we had to submit, you know, we had to say what we were going to do, but then they exempted it. And in fact, I can honestly say one agency that we spoke with, they were very, very upset that this had happened, and they said, well, we're going to, you know, we're going to contact your IRB. And so that's also something I would just put out there, as if and when we would move forward with a project like that again, there are a lot of things that we learned in that process that we would do differently. No, so that's a great question. So when the secret shoppers went in, there were certain criteria. We only wanted them to go to sites and get tested where there was an ID required, because that's a really common concern in the populations that we work with, that they don't have ID and they'll go to get tested and they get turned away. So we only wanted to include agencies where that was where they didn't need to have ID. And then we gave cash to our research assistants. And we told them to report that they had no health insurance, that they had no ID, et cetera, and see how that went. And if the test was more than $60, then they didn't get tested, and they walked away. And there were four sites where that happened. So I think we had a total list of 53, and four of the sites were taken out for that reason, because it was more than $60. And again, the majority of folks who are in the populations that we're working with, they're not going to pay more than $60 out of pocket for an STI test.
Any more questions? Emily is our presenter who has to run. So
yeah, I'm really sorry. They moved my flight up. I apologize. I don't want to be rude.
Okay.
Yeah.
But we want to make sure that we have.
I can give you a card. Absolutely, absolutely. I'll give you a card and we can chat, and there's also on our website, there's a lot of that information as well, so you'll have both sources, but definitely get in touch, we can chat, yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you.